Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, today's speaker is Greg Bowman, and he will be speaking on Shakespeare and the idea of redemption. Let's listen in on Greg.
I'm going to start with some scenes from the recent Kenneth Branagh production of Much Ado About Nothing. Briefly, Much Ado About Nothing is has a main plot and a subplot. We're not going to deal with the main plot, the love story between Beatrice and Benedick. What I'm going to be dealing with is the subplot. Essentially, all you need to know is that Claudio, who is played by Robert Sean Leonard in this movie, has been betrothed to Hero, who, I forget the actress's name. At any rate, they're about to get married, but a villain by the name of Don John has made Claudio, just the previous night before their marriage, he has shown Claudio Hero's window, and Hero has seen, Claudio has seen a woman with a man in that window, and the villain makes Claudio think that he is seeing Hero. Actually, he is seeing a servant, but he thinks that he has seen Hero engage in sex here the night before his marriage. And this is the wedding scene that follows on the next day.
To be married to her. You come to marry her. Lady, you come hither to be married to this count.
I do.
If either of you have any inward impediment why you should not be conjoined, I charge you, on your souls, to utter it.
Know you any hero?
None, my lord.
Know you any count?
I dare make his answer. None.
Stand me by, Frank.
Father, by your leave, will you with free and unconstrained soul give me this maid, your daughter?
As freely, son, as God did give her me.
And what have I to give you back, whose worth may counterpoise this rich and precious gift?
Nothing, unless you render her again.
Sweet prince, you learn me noble thankfulness.
The resistance of her youth and made defeat of her virginity.
No! I never tempted her with words too large. As a brother to his sister, showed bashful sincerity and comely love.
And seemed I ever otherwise to you?
You seem to be as Diane in her form. But you are more intemperate in your blood than Venus. Pampered animals that rage in savage sensuality.
If I don't well, then you speak so wise.
Sweet prince, why speak of you? What should I speak?
I stand dishonored that I've gone about to link my dear friend to a common stale.
What man was he talked with you yesternight, out at your window betwixt 12 and 1?
I talked with no man at that hour, my noble!
Why, then you are no maiden.
Dear Otto, I'm sorry you must hear. Upon mine honor, myself, my brother and this grieved count did see her, hear her,
at that hour last night, talk with a ruffian at her chamber window, who hath indeed, most like a liberal villain, confessed
that was a sermon,
the
wild
encounters
the
they have had a thousand times in secret.
Let us go. These things come thus to light, smother her spirit, son.
God, dear God, my lord, she
One of the things about Shakespeare's later comedies is that he wants to see how close he can get to a tragedy before bringing him back to a comedy. I think that's one of the points here. I mean, this is real potential for tragedy. You know, you change the plot around a little bit and you you might have a different play that ends in tragedy.
Still Much Ado.
Yeah, this is Still Much Ado. Yeah, notice how quickly the father is to believe what's going on here.
Grieve die, I had but one. Why had I one? Why ever wast thou lovely in my eyes? She is fallen into a pit of
sir, sir, be patient. For my part, I am so attired in wonder, I know not what to say.
Well, on my soul, my cousin, it belies.
What do you have, bedfellow, last night?
No, truly not, although until last night I have been 12 months being her bedfellow.
Confirm!
Still believe.
With the duplicity lie, and Claudio lie. Hence from her, let her die.
Hear me a little. Lady, what man is he you are accused of?
They murmur to accuse me.
There is some strange misprision in the princess.
Two of them have the very bent of honor. And if their wisdom has been misled in this, the practice of it lives in John the Bastard.
If they wrong her honor, the proudest of them shall well hear of it.
Pause the royal. And let my counsel sway you in this case. Your daughter here, the princess left for dead. Let her a while be secretly kept in and published that she is dead indeed.
What shall become of this?
She dying, as it must be so maintained, upon the instant that she was accused, shall be lamented, pitied, and excused of every hearer. So will it fare with Claudio, when he shall hear she died upon his words. The idea of her life shall sweetly creep into his study of imagination. And every lovely organ of her life shall come apparelled in more precious habit than when she lived indeed. Then shall he mourn and wish he had not so accused her.
Signor Leonato, let the friar advise you.
Meaning that I flow in grief, the smallest twine may lead me.
'Tis welcome, sir. Come, lady. Die to live. This wedding day perhaps is but prolonged. Have patience and endure.
Can I replay that?
Leave me. 'Tis well consented. Presently away. Come, lady. Die to live.
Come, lady, die to live, is what he says. I don't know how much, the sound quality really isn't this good because I can't get the sound to go through the main speakers, and so they're just going through the TV. I don't know how much of it you heard, but essentially the friar was saying, let's publish that you actually died from grief or from the accusation here, and then Claudio will forget the sin that made you die and will remember you how you lived. And so he's essentially saying die to live. Shakespeare seemed to have become enamored of this idea. I'm going to see if I can get the display back. Give a couple more scenes from this. But in his later plays, I counted 8 plays where he plays with this idea of dying to live, where one character dies. Where one character dies, and then in the course of the play, then is brought back to life. Sort of dies through trickery, or is reported dead, and then later on in the play is brought back to life. He found this. He seemed to have found this idea. I don't know if we can say he found religion later in his plays. This doesn't occur at all in the earlier plays. This is the earliest play that it occurs. Much Ado About Nothing, which is about right midway through his career. I'm just going to show the rest of this to show you how this plays out. There's this one scene here in which it's been discovered now. He has discovered that he was misinformed and that he had mistakenly seen a hero at the window. And this is his reaction. Essentially, he goes through a period of mourning. Out a little bit longer, but the scene isn't Shakespeare, and you wonder why he has to put in this extra scene. You know, once hero has been discovered to be blameless, you wonder why they don't just go ahead and go with the marriage. And it seems to me that Shakespeare is throwing in this extra idea to enhance the idea of dying to live and the redemption. Now here's the final marriage. Oh, as a plot background, what has happened is that in sort of penance, Claudio has agreed to marry another relative of Leonardo's. And so, you know, you didn't have the one that you wanted, but you are going to marry now someone else, and you can't look on her until you have said that, yes, you have married her. And this is the scene as it's played out.
To this fair assembly?
Good morrow, Prince. Good morrow, Claudio. We here attend you. Are you yet determined today to marry with my brother's daughter? Call her forth, brother. Here's the friar ready.
Which is the lady I must seize upon?
The same is she, and I do give you her.
Sweet. Let me see her face.
No, that you shall not. Till you take her hand before this friar and swear to marry her.
Give me your hand before this holy friar. I am your husband. If you like of me.
Thank you.
surrendered, I'll tell you largely a fair hero's death.
And so on, and then the rest of it involves the resolution of the main plot. You can hear the echoes, couldn't you? Hero died, defiled, but as I live, I am a maid. Or hero was dead only while her slander lived, and now that she has been renewed, she lives again. I can't think of the word that Shakespeare actually uses, but do you hear the echoes? My question is just exactly why do you think Shakespeare has us go through this process with Claudio? It seems to me that it's almost excessive.
It's much more dramatic this way. Mm-hmm. To stage the funeral and Claudio's grief and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost as if I think Claudio needs to do some penance for what he has done.
For jumping to conclusions.
Yeah.
But her father, I mean, he gets off pretty light. I think he was ready to kill her.
Mm-hmm.
On the words of one or two people.
Yes, and he says too, confirmed, just on the basis that she slept alone that night. I mean, the fact that she slept alone to him is confirmation. The father does get off lightly, and one of my professors too has asked. He can't possibly see why in the world Hero would want him. Not her father, but Claudio again. After that very nasty public humiliation. So maybe the extra scenes are a type of penance, a catharsis for the audience to go through.
How would you stage it otherwise? How would you stage their reconciliation? I mean, he just walks up to her and says, "Oh, I believe you are indeed a maid. Let's get married."
Yeah, I'm not sure. Well, like this idea of dying to live, the other plays that it comes up in, All's Well That Ends Well, Measure for Measure, Cymbeline, Pericles, Winter's Tale, The Tempest, all have characters who are believed to be dead, and Twelfth Night, all have characters who are believed to be dead, and then they have some sort of recognition, reconciliation at the end. The one that I want to look at specifically is Measure for Measure, and then we'll get to King Lear, which has a different type of redemption, I think. Shakespeare, I think, portrays this redemption in two ways, and we saw both of the ways here. First of all, there's a sense of forgiveness, an admittance that a fault has occurred, and second of all, there's this whole idea of new life, the dying to live. The redemption, the forgiveness, occurs most poignantly, I think, in King Lear, but I do want to show one other dying to live scene, and this is at the end of Measure for Measure, those of you who have books. I have some copies, too, if others of you want to look. At this scene. Measure for Measure. It should be in the comedies in there. The basic plot behind Measure for Measure, to give you a background to the scene I want to look at, which is Act 5, Scene 1, by the way. The basic plot of Measure to Measure involves a woman whose brother has been accused of premarital sex. And the provost, not the provost, but the shall we say, vice, in more ways than one, the vice master in charge of Vienna, in the Duke's absence, is real strict and finds the premarital affair to be worthy of death. As a result, the nun comes to plead to him for her brother's life, and the man's name is Angelo. He finds the nun so attractive that he says, "I will save your brother if you have a wanton affair with me." Isabella says, "Of course, I will not go for that." But she agrees to the affair, and in place of her, she commits she engages in the bed trick. She replaces herself with somebody else who, at one point, had already had an affair with this Angelo. Angelo then goes ahead and kills the brother anyway, or so he thinks. He gives the order for the brother's death, and then the Duke, who had left Angelo in charge in his absence, then reveals that he was the friar sort of behind the scenes manipulating everything. He comes out and he accuses Angelo of this trickery with Isabella, and the whole scene sort of comes to a close with the Duke sentencing this Angelo to death. And here's where we get, again, both the forgiveness and the die to live scene. This is Act 5, Scene 1. It's around my line 400 or so. This might change in other editions depending on how much prose is in the scene. Line numbers can change. But I'm beginning at a place where it says, "Enter Angelo, Mariana, Friar Peter, and Provost." Do other people, have you found this scene?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Could I have readers for this? Somebody to read Isabella, somebody to read Mariana. I'll do the Duke. And we can throw in others as they come in. Is Measure for Measure not in those? Oh, I'm sorry. Here,
try this one.
Can somebody read Mariana? Okay. Isabella? Okay, you can read Isabella. And I'll read the Duke, and that should get us through most of the scene. The Duke, I'm going to start line 400 for this new married man. Can you see where I am? Okay. Duke says, "For this new married man approaching here, whose salt imagination hath wronged your well-defended honor, you must pardon for Mariana's sake, but as he adjudged your brother being criminal in double violation of sacred chastity and of promise breach, thereupon dependent for your brother's life, the most very mercy of the law cries out, most audible, even from his proper tongue, an Angelo for Claudio, death for death. Haste still paced hastes, and leisure answers leisure. Like doth quit like, and measure still for measure. Then, Angelo, thy fault is thus manifested, which though thou wouldst deny, denies thee vantage. We do condemn thee to the very block where Claudio stooped to death, and with like haste. Away with him." The Duke, in other words, is commanding him to death because he killed Isabella's brother, Claudio. And Mariana, who is beloved of Angelo, replies,
"Oh, my most gracious lord, I hope you will not mock me with a husband."
"It is your husband mocked you with a husband, consenting to the safeguard of your honor. I thought your marriage fit, else imputation, for that he knew you, might reproach your life and choke your good to come. For his possessions, although by confiscation, they are ours. We do instate and widow you withal to bury you a better husband." He's going to marry her to him anyway and then kill him afterwards. Go ahead, Mariana.
"Oh, my dear lord, I crave no other, nor no better man."
"Neither crave him. We are definitive."
"Gentle, my liege."
"You do but lose your labor. Away with him to death." "Now, sir, to you." He's going to judge somebody else.
"Oh, my good lord, sweet Isabel, take my part. Lend me your knees, and all my life to come, I'll lend you all my life to do you service."
"Against all sense you do importune her. Should she kneel down in mercy of this fact, her brother's ghost his paved bed would break, and take her hence in horror."
"Isabel, sweet Isabel, do yet but kneel by me. Hold up your hands, say nothing. I'll speak all. They say best men are molded out of faults, and for the most become much more the better for being a little bad. So may my husband, O Isabel, will you not lend a knee?"
He dies for Claudio's death. And now Isabel has to come to aid of Mariana and sue for mercy for the man who killed her brother and the man who made sexual advances to her. And this is what she says.
"Most bounteous sir, look. If it please you, on this man condemned, as if my brother lived, I partly think a due sincerity governed his deeds. Till he did look on me, since it is so, let him not die. My brother had but justice in that he did the thing for which he died. For Angelo, his act did not overtake his bad intent, and must be buried but as an intent that perished by the way. Thoughts are no subjects, intents, but merely thoughts."
Okay, now this is an interesting idea here. She's saying essentially, first of all, she says my brother deserved what he got because he did commit the act for which he was killed, but Angelo did not do the act that he intended to do. In other words, he intended to take me to bed, but he did not do this. Instead, he bedded somebody else. And so since he didn't commit the act, he just had the intent to act, he should be held blameless. Now, I was told, and perhaps the theologians in the audience could better help me with this, but I was told that this shows a Protestant viewpoint rather than a Catholic viewpoint of a sin that is not committed because the thought is not the sin rather than the act is the sin, but the thought is not the sin. Is this true?
Catholics tend to be more they make gradations of sins more than Protestants do. And I would say it would be actually more Catholic than Protestant.
To say that the sin was not committed because the act was not committed?
Right.
Rather than, okay. Well, just a footnote to that. Let's go on. Mariana says, she says, thoughts are no subjects, intents but merely thoughts. And Mariana echoes, your suit is unprofitable. Stand up, I say. I have bethought me of another fault. Provost, how came it Claudio was beheaded at an unusual hour? Provost responds, it was commanded so. Had you a special warrant for the deed? And he responds, no, my good lord, it was by private message. For which I do discharge you of your office. Give up your keys. And we can skip down a little bit here. Essentially, the Duke is trying to find other fault for Angelo in killing Claudio before his appointed time. Prisoners are brought in. Bernardine, who's a comic relief character, and then Claudio is also brought in, muffled. And skipping down to line 490 here. The provost says, this is another prisoner that I have saved who should have died when Claudio lost his head, as like almost to Claudio as himself. And then Claudio is unmasked, and the Duke says, if he be like your brother, is he pardoned? And then there comes a strange line, and for your lovely sake, give me your hand and say you will be mine. He is my brother too. There's been no indication that there's been any wooing between the Duke and Isabella throughout this whole play, and then suddenly the Duke says, because we have to have a marriage at the end and this is a comedy after all, the Duke says, give me your hand and say you will be mine and he is my brother too, and we have this wedding between the Duke and Isabella, which comes out of nowhere. But fitter time for that. By this Lord Angelo perceives he's safe. Methinks I see a quickening in his eye. Well, Angelo, your evil quits you well. Look that you love your wife, her worth yours. I find an apt remission in myself, and yet here's one in place I cannot pardon. And then he turns to somebody else who's been sort of abusive throughout the whole play. One more line, and then we'll go to another play. Down with line 520 or so, the Duke says, upon mine honor, thou shalt marry her. Thy slanders I forgive, and therewithal remit thy other forfeits. The Duke here is acting as a pardoner of sins, and he's forgiving the faults as he's recovering Claudio from death. Again, this is another character who has to die in his faults to live without them. Comments at this point?
Is there some psychological part of this that you have to die to your old self, but the new self that's born out of that grief and that process is a better, stronger person? Is that a Shakespeare thought?
I think a case could be made for that. Certainly Christian critics have field days with this concept, dying to a better self and the forgiveness of sins.
Like a deeper, richer personality in some ways.
Yeah, possibly. It's almost excessive. I mean, the length that the characters have to go through in Shakespeare to become a better person, it almost seems a little bit excessive. But you would imagine that they come out of this with a better understanding. I would hope that at least Claudio and Hero's marriage from Much Ado About Nothing would be better than their wedding. in some respects.
Would have been had they married originally without that.
Possibly, yeah. Who knows if he would have been more likely to believe slander's fault if that hadn't occurred. Yes, go ahead.
Is there any indication in the literature from that era if people on that day put any of these interpretations on these plays, on Shakespeare's?
It's hard to say. The amount of writings that exist still in which people comment on the plays is very, very scant. Most of the people, when they see a play, will write in their journals, "I saw a play and here was the plot." They won't say, "I saw a play and here's what it meant." And so it's very hard to determine what people interpreted. For the most part, if they did have an interpretation on plays, the interpretation was perceived to be political. They would find political allegory to events of the day. Richard II contains a deposition scene, which was very, very controversial to a queen at the time who felt that she was surrounded by people who wanted to depose her, the Earl of Essex being one. And when the Earl of Essex plot came to light, they wanted to perform Richard II for the Queen, and she refused because she said, "I am Richard." This is a famous quote. "I am Richard," and refused to have it. And thereafter, from there until her death, whenever Richard II was performed or when it was published, that scene was cut out. The deposition scene. They did tend to find political allegory. And Shakespeare, too, almost all of Shakespeare's plays, with very few exceptions, take place either in England's past, long past, 100 years or so, or else in another country. Shakespeare is very careful not to present plays, unlike other authors of the period, not to present plays that took place at this time in this place. Because he feared that there would be too much interpretation put on it. As for the religious interpretation, it's really hard to say. They, for the most part, in the plays, they avoided religious topics unless they wanted to find a scapegoat. Malvolio in Twelfth Night is very clearly a Puritan who is held as a scapegoat and held up for ridicule. But for the most part, they seem to have avoided overt.
They have the same sort of theological look at the world at the time, maybe.
Possibly. The theological view at the time was largely determined by the monarchy. They had just undergone a period in their recent past where the monarchy had reverted to Catholicism. After Henry VIII had decreed Protestantism, then they had Catholicism for a brief period and then went back to Protestantism. And it's very hard when your faction has been in power and then out of power and then back in power again. You're real tenuous about trying to declare your religious convictions, especially since it looks like the next king, the heir apparent, has Catholic bents as well. So I think that religious ideas were real tenuous at the time. The drama of this period too is remarkably secular, considering that 100 years ago most of the drama was religious in nature. The drama at the time dealt with religious themes and with religious stories. You know, you'd see the story of Noah presented, you'd see the story of the birth of Jesus presented in all sorts of dramas. And so in contrast to that, the drama of the time is remarkably secular. But you do have these snippets. Go ahead.
Well, if I were going to hazard a guess, it would seem to me that the piety, what the kings were able to decree were the forms that were to be used, but you can't decree the piety of the people. Mm-hmm. And the piety of the people was essentially Catholic piety. My guess would be that Shakespeare's own piety was essentially Catholic. Henry died in 1547, and the only divergence from Catholic tradition was the disobedience to the Pope until Edward VII or Edward VI.
Edward VI, yeah.
And so Mary has no difficulty reinstating Catholicism, and the only thing that was unpopular about Mary was her marriage to Philip II, not the piety. Mm-hmm. The piety of the people was not opposed to Mary. Elizabeth steers a very careful course. The Elizabethan settlement allows for Catholic forms with some Protestant reforms, But essentially, during Elizabeth's reign, the piety of the people is largely unchanged from what it was in Henry VIII. And this is why James I and Charles I don't have much difficulty with large segments of the population with their Catholicizing piety. Mm-hmm. And so if you put Shakespeare in that period, what you're going to largely get is a popular piety that's essentially Catholic. His friars, I mean, the specifically religious figures he has are all not Protestant clerics, but Catholic clergy. Mm-hmm. And I think, too, Hans is right, that distinguishing between thought and act is Catholic rather than Protestant. Protestant would be the Jimmy Carter, you know, if I've thought it in my heart, I've done it. Mm-hmm. That's Protestant. Mm-hmm. The gradations, the distinctions, that's still essentially Catholic piety.
Well, I probably got my note mixed up. I remember my professor making the distinction, and I probably just reversed it in my...
probably did.
In my notes.
Just remember Jimmy Carter, and then you
got it. Okay, I want to move on to Lear. I don't have a watch. How are we doing on time? Is it 11:15?
15 minutes.
Okay. I do want to move on to Lear because Lear, in my opinion, Lear is probably the best of Shakespeare's tragedies, and it also has this real clear sense of redemption that is happening, not only in the main plot, but in the subplot. Let me give you a brief... a synopsis of what is going on. Those of you who were here yesterday, we did the first scene in Lear, in which the whole play is sort of given a not a push, but a bang. It starts and the tragedy happens almost immediately with suddenness, both in the main plot and in the subplot. Essentially, Lear has given up his kingdom, and he wants his daughters to receive a part of his kingdom by telling them how much they love him. Two of the daughters use flowery language and rhetoric and words and conventions to say that they have. The third daughter says nothing. And Lear is so enraged by this that he disowns his third daughter and divides up the kingdom between his two daughters, and hasn't really learned the difference between... feeling love and speaking love. Speaking love is probably not as valuable as feeling love, but Lear hasn't learned this. And in the course of this play, too, Gloucester, in the subplot, disowns his true son for his bastard son on the basis of rumor, innuendo, and the like. And both of them, for Shakespeare, both of them have to undergo some sort of redemption, some sort of learning. I'm going to take you to the middle of a play. I'm touching briefly on a scene in Act 3, Scene 7. And by the way, King Lear is the most difficult text to follow along. If you find that scenes change, if you find lines change, if you find that words are not in one edition but are in the other, it's because there are two equally good versions of Lear, and it's hard to combine the two into one text. There are a lot of textual problems that don't exist in other plays, so I hope you will bear with me if you can't find exactly the scene. In Act 3, Scene 7, again in the center of the play, I was saying yesterday that everything in Shakespeare occurs in the center, important. You have the blinding of Gloucester on stage, which is one of the most gruesome scenes that I've seen in theater history. Most of the time when something happens that is mutilating, it happens off stage. You have here the blinding of Gloucester on stage. They did this with a stage trick. One actor would have a little pig's bladder full of blood in his hand, and so when he pushes his eyes and squeeze it, you know, the blood will come out of the bladder, and then the guy can clap his hand and you see all this blood on stage. Or else he'll have something attached to his face, to his cheek probably, that can be filled with again, pig's blood. And the other one, when he kicks his eye out, he'll have a spike on his, or something on his toe, and will kick it against his cheek, puncture the bladder so that it looks like there's blood coming out, and again he claps his eye on. So it's, if it's done correctly and real quickly, you see the poke and he claps his eye, and then there's this blood coming out. It's a gimmick in some respects, but it is very gruesome to watch, especially if you've seen King Lear performed. Exactly how they do this trick and make it look realistic can have a real, if they do it well, can have a real unnerving effect on the audience. I touch on that because I'm going to point out a scene where Edgar, his own son, says that this was justly done. A lot of problems with that. After this scene, now Gloucester has disowned his oldest son, Edgar. Edgar has taken a disguise as a beggar in the meantime, and he meets up with Gloucester after Gloucester has been blinded and thrust out. He meets up with him, and this is the scene that occurs. This is Act 4, Scene 1, when he meets up with him. Can somebody read the old man, and I'll read Gloucester.
I'll read the old man.
Okay, why don't you start line... oh, good, my lord. Do you see that? Line 10 or so?
Oh, my good, yes.
Oh, my good lord.
I have been your tenant and your father's tenant these 80 years.
Away, get thee away, good friend, be gone. Thy comforts can do me no good at all. Thee they may hurt.
You cannot see your way.
I have no way, and therefore want no eyes. I stumbled when I saw. Full oft 'tis seen, our means secure us, and our mere defects prove our commodities. O dear son Edgar, the fool of thy abused father's wrath, might I but live to see thee in my touch, I'd say I'd have eyes again.
How now? Who's there?
We need an Edgar too. Can somebody read Edgar?
Sure.
Okay.
O gods, whose can say I'm the worst? I'm the worst that e'er I was, than e'er I was.
'Tis poor Mad Tom.
And worse I may be yet, the worst is not, so long as we can say this.
This is a real pessimistic view. Same could be said of the best, I suppose. You know, the best is not as long as we can say this is the best, but he says the worst is not. You know, if it can get worse, then what do we... How can we say that now is the worst? Go on, fellow.
Fellow, where goest?
Is it a beggar man?
Madman and beggar too.
He has some reason, else he could not beg. In last night's storm, I such a fellow saw, which made me think a man a worm. My son came into my mind, and yet my mind was then scarce friends with him. I have heard more since. As flies to wanton boys are we to the gods. They kill us for their sport.
How should this be? Bad is the trade that must play fool to sorrow, anger itself and others. Bless thee, master.
Is that the naked fellow?
Aye, my lord.
Then prithee, get thee away. If for my sake thou wilt o'ertake us hence a mile or twain in the way towards Dover, do it for ancient love, and bring some covering for this naked soul, which I'll entreat to lead me. Essentially, we can stop here. Essentially, this is the meeting between Edgar and Gloucester, and Edgar is leading Gloucester, going to lead Gloucester to the cliffs of Dover. As flies to wanton boys are we to the gods, they kill us for their sport. Gloucester doesn't seem to have learned anything from earlier in the play when he blames the stars, he blames outside forces for what happens to us. That's just a prelude to the crucial scene that I want to present, and that's Act 4, Scene 6, where Edgar and Gloucester are led to the cliff. And I want to ask, as we go through the scene, why do you think Shakespeare does this? Why do you think Edgar does this? What purpose does this serve? Luke, can you continue with Edgar?
Sure.
Starting at the beginning of the scene. When shall I come to the top of the same hill?
You do climb up now. Look how we labor.
Methinks the ground is even.
Horrible steep. Hark, do you hear the sea?
No, truly.
Why, then your other senses grow imperfect, but your eyes, by your eyes, anguish.
So may it indeed. Methinks thy voice is altered, and thou speak'st in better phrase and matter than thou didst.
You are much deceived. In nothing am I changed, but in my garments.
Methinks you are better spoken.
Come on, sir. Here's the place. Stand still. How fearful and dizzy 'tis to cast one's eyes so low. The crows and shots that wing in the midway air show scarce so gross as beetles. Halfway down hangs one that gathers samphire, dreadful trait. Methinks he seems no bigger than his head. The fishermen that walk upon the beach appear like mice, and yon tall anchoring bark diminished to hear a cock, a boy, almost too small for sight. The murmuring surfs that on the unnumbered idle pebbles chased cannot be heard so high. I'll look no more, but my brain turned on the deficient sight, topple down headlong.
Set me where you stand.
Give me your hand. You are now within a foot of the extreme verge. For all beneath the moon would I not be upright.
Let go my hand. Here, friend, is another purse. In it a jewel well worth a poor man's taking. Fairies and gods prosper it with thee. Go thou further off, bid me farewell, and let me hear thee going.
Now, fare thee well, good sir.
With all my heart.
Why I do trifle thus with his despair is done to cure it.
Yes, why I do trifle thus with his despair is done to cure it. The gag here, it's hard to tell with this scene not being presented. Essentially, he's not led him to Dover. You know, he's just said that he's led him to Dover. So that when Gloucester, and then as he continues, he kneels, he says, "O you mighty gods, this world I do renounce, and in your sights shake patiently my great affliction off. If I could bear it longer and not fall to quarrel with your great opposeless wills, my snuff and loathed part of nature should burn itself out. If Edgar live, O bless him. Now, fellow, fare thee well." And he falls, but he falls not down the cliffs of Dover, but just in front of him, a couple feet, yeah.
You keep going?
Yeah, keep going.
Gone, sir, farewell. And yet I know not how conceit may rob the treasury of life when life itself yields to the theft. Had he been where he thought, by this had thought been passed, alive or dead? Ho you, sir, friend, hear you, sir, speak. Thus might he pass indeed, yet he revives. What are you, sir?
Away and let me die.
Hadst thou been aught but gossamer, feathers, air, some may fathom down precipitating. Thou'd shiver like an egg, but thou dost breathe. Hast heavy substance, bleedst not, speakst, art sound. 10 masts at each make not the altitude which thou hast perpendicularly fell. Thy life's a miracle. Speak yet again.
But have I fallen or no?
From the dread summit of this chalky bourne. Look up a height. The shrill gorged lark so far cannot be seen or heard, but do but look up.
Alack, I have no eyes. Is wretchedness deprived that benefit to end itself by death? 'Twas yet some comfort when misery could beguile the tyrant's rage and frustrate his proud will.
Give me your eye. Up so. How is it? Feel your legs? You stand?
Too well, too well.
This is above all strangeness. Upon the crown of the cliff, what thing was that which parted for thee?
A poor, unfortunate beggar.
As I stood here below, methought his eyes were two full moons. He had 1,000 noses, horns whelped and waved like the enriched sea. It was some fiend. Therefore, thou happy father, think that the clearest gods, who make them honors of men's impossibilities, have preserved thee.
I do remember now. Henceforth I'll bear affliction till it do cry out itself, enough, enough, and die. That thing what you speak of, I took it for a man. Often 'twould say, the fiend, he led me to that place.
Bear free and patient thoughts.
Okay, and this is the end of the scene. He says, henceforth I'll bear affliction till it do cry out itself. And this is actually not true, because at the very end, Gloucester's last scene, Edgar says, Gloucester says, no further, sir, a man may rot even here. and Edgar has to say, "What, in ill thoughts again? Men must endure their going hence, even as they're coming hither. Ripeness is all." In other words, be prepared for your death. "Come on." And Gloucester responds, "Oh, and that's true, too." He sort of ends with a wishy-washy attitude. But he does say, at least here, "Henceforth I'll bear affliction till it do cry out itself, enough, enough, and die." Why is it important for Shakespeare to lead Gloucester through this mock fall?
Day of Atonement.
What do you mean?
In Israel, they would pour their sins out upon a goat and then drive them off the cliff, and so the goat went to sin.
Well, I think, Greg, since you're asking this, what do you think about it? I've thought about this quite a lot. I think that it expresses the person who's really changed is the son. Mm-hmm. And he loves his father, and I think he does it, as he says, for therapeutic reasons, that his father needs to somehow go through some kind of a death so that he comes to a better understanding of life.
But you think it's the son that's changed?
Yes. Edgar has changed.
Yeah, and in what way?
Well, he was pretty much a naive... I don't want to go through a whole spiel. He is very naive... gullible.
Okay, I misunderstood you. I thought you meant he's changed in this scene, but you mean he's changed through the play.
Yes.
Okay, but in this scene, it's the fall is for his father's sake.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right. He's engineering it. I think. I want to argue about that. What a loving, what a loving thing to do to your father, make him go through a near death experience and fool him and so on, and don't declare yourself to him. He never has a chance to see his father. His father dies before he has a chance to see him again. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of ways in which it grates against insensibility, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit like playing God. Well, you need to have this experience, this therapeutic experience, so that you can be cured of your ill thoughts.
Yeah, and I'm not exactly sure, as I point out in the later scene, I'm not exactly sure that he is cured.
Right, exactly.
I think the curing comes and goes.
Exactly.
And Edgar remains with Gloucester through the rest of the play to sort of act as this constant reminder that, that you have been cured, and for Gloucester to say, "Oh, yeah, you're right, and that's true, too," and to go back and forth.
It's problematic, though, I think. Mm-hmm. It really is.
Well, let's quickly get to the main plot. This is Lear and Cordelia, and Lear again has had has a similar scene, but this is without Cordelia sort of engineering, sort of playing God, in contrast. Cordelia has been seen by Christian critics as a Christ figure earlier in the play. She says, "Oh, dear Father, it is thy business that I go about." Which everybody just loves, it seems, among the Christian critics. The scene that I want to look at, and this is Hans, your favorite scene, is that what you like?
One of
them, yes. Act 4, Scene 7. Lear has just experienced his madness. He's been driven mad by his other daughters being ungrateful. And in his madness, he is carried by a doctor back to Cordelia, who has returned from France. And he awakes, and Cordelia says, could somebody read for Cordelia? Starting line 45 in this scene, or before. How does my royal lord? How fares your majesty? Have you found it?
Oh.
I don't have a 4-7, I have a 4-6.
Yeah, that's... that addition is particularly problematic in that respect. Okay. How does my royal lord?
How does my royal lord? How fares your majesty?
You do me wrong to take me out of the grave. Thou art a soul in bliss, but I am bound upon a wheel of fire that mine own tears do scald like molten lead.
Sir, do you know me?
You are a spirit, I know. When did you die?
Still, far wide.
Meaning that she thinks he's still mad. Doctor says he's scarce awake, let him alone a while, and he responds, where have I been? Where am I? Fair daylight? I am mightily abused. I should even die with pity to see another thus. I know not what to say. I will not swear these are my hands. Let's see. I feel this pinprick. Would I were assured of my condition.
Oh, look upon me, sir, and hold your hand in benediction o'er me. No, sir, you must not kneel.
Pray, do not mock me. I am a very foolish, fond old man, fourscore and upward, not an hour more nor less. And to deal plainly, I fear I am not in my perfect mind. Methinks I should know you, and know this man. Yet I am doubtful, for I am mainly ignorant what place this is, and all the skill I have remembers not these garments, nor I know not where I did lodge last night. Do not laugh at me, for as I am a man, I think this lady to be my child, Cordelia.
And so I am.
Be your tears wet. Yes, Faith, I pray weep not. For if you have poison for me, I will drink it. I know you do not love me, for your sisters have, as I do remember, done me wrong. You have some cause. They have not.
No cause.
And that is just the ultimate line. No cause. Cordelia has the most reason to be angry with Lear, but yet she says no cause. No cause. And that's a real touching scene. And it affects Lear too in a real profound way when they're captured. This is one scene later. Lear can only think, let's away to prison where we two will sing like birds in the cage. When thou dost ask me a blessing, I'll kneel down and ask thee forgiveness. So we'll live and pray and sing and tell old tales and laugh at gilded butterflies and hear poor rogues talk of court news. And we'll talk with them too, who loses, who wins, who's in, who's out, and take upon the mystery of things as if we were God's spies, and we'll wear out in a walled prison, packs and sex of great ones that ebb and flow by the moon. I mean, he doesn't care that he's captured, just as long as he can beg forgiveness and she can grant it again. It really is it's a touching relationship. And it intensifies the tragic ending all the more, I think.